It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. It's another event-filled Patch Tuesday retrospective. We'll talk about a new automated attack framework. The script kiddies are going to just love a replacement for TrueCrypt for Linux. It gives you plausible deniability. And then he'll take a look at the NSA's proposal for memory-safe languages. This is one everyone should pay attention to next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 897, recorded Tuesday, November 15th, 2022. Memory Safe Languages. Security Now is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that could drastically increase your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. And by ExpressVPN. Make sure your online activity and data are protected with the best VPN money can buy. Visit expressvpn.com/security right now and get 3 extra months free when you buy a 1-year package. And by Grammarly. The right tone can move any project forward when you get it just right with Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/tone to download and learn more about Grammarly Premium's advanced tone suggestions. It's time for Security Now, the show where we talk about your security and privacy online with our guy right here, this cat, Mr. Stephen Gibson of the
GRC.
We
will protect you whether you want it or not.
Hi, Steve. Happy Tuesday. We survived Election Day, and we are now on to other
things. Well, we got tonight's announcement from Mar-a-Lago.
Oh, that's right. So it's huge.
It will be at 6 p.m. Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern, for those who are interested. I'm certainly a spectator.
I will be watching.
I will be glued with my popcorn, and we'll see what happens. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Also fun is today's topic. This is another one of these weeks where there was no, like, major cyber research that was – I always like to, you know, to track cyber research things. Nothing really happened except a bunch of news, except that the NSA published a real interesting sort of an appeal to everyone – to seriously consider switching to the use of memory-safe languages.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Thus the title of today's episode of Security Now, 897 for November 15th, Memory-Safe Languages. We're going to do a little retrospective on the event-filled, more eventful than Microsoft would have wished, Patch Tuesday. We're going to look at a newly published, horrifying, automated host attack framework, which script kiddies are sure to be jumping on. We've got a welcome new feature that's been introduced into GitHub. Also, some three critical vulnerabilities in the it's only sixth in the world, but that gives it 1.9 million instances, the Lightspeed web server.
Oh.
We've also got something I think is going to be of interest to our Linux users, the spiritual successor to TrueCrypt and VeraCrypt for Linux.
Oh.
And then we're going to do a little segment, 2.5 minutes we're going to play, of Australia's announcement of their intention to proactively attack the attackers.
Oh,
which
that doesn't
I don't
sound
know how
good.
You I don't know how you could do that legally.
Yikes.
It's like, okay. And boy, she's pissed off. We've also got a controversial new feature that was added to iOS 16.1.1. Also, I just have to touch on a couple more decentralized finance catastrophes. Believe it or not, Leo, other than the collapse of FTX last week or weekend before last, we've also got some miscellany and listener feedback. And then we're going to wrap up by taking a look at this National Security Agency promotion of the use of memory safe languages. So I think another great podcast for our listeners. Oh, and because of last Tuesday's election, they put up a chart on the screen at one point there where I just said, okay, stop everything. Hold on. This is just so wrong. And we probably talked about this last year, but again, I just can't resist because this is just, it just makes my blood boil. It's like, who's in charge?
I'm looking at it. I'm trying to figure out what you don't like about it. We'll find out in just a little bit. Oh, I see. Yes, I do see.
It's green. Green is like way bigger than orange.
Yes, you're right. I see. We'll show you in a second. Okay. now that I look at it, yes. Oh. Interesting. Huh. It's a perspective thing. You just wouldn't understand, Steve. It's all about TV production.
I have a lack of perspective. That's right.
Our show today.
That's been said before. So,
yeah. Our show today is brought to you by the password manager I use and love and been recommending for some time now, Bitwarden. I'm a big fan. Now, you probably know if you listen to this show that you've got to have a password manager. In fact, if you listen to this show and you're not using a password manager, you're not listening to the show, obviously.
Yeah, right? Stop listening.
Pay attention. So really, this is not necessarily for you. This might be for a friend or a family member that you're helping secure. It might be if you're unhappy with your current password manager. I love Bitwarden. I've always, for a long time, I've said that encryption is not reliable if it's not open source. If you don't know what they're doing, how are you going to know if they're doing it right? I kind of feel the same way about a password manager. Bitwarden is the only open source, there's point one, very important, cross-platform, works everywhere, Windows, Mac, Linux, everywhere, iOS, Android, password manager that can be used at home. You can have a personal edition at work. They've got business versions on the go and is trusted by millions. This is a really great solution. With Bitwarden, you can securely store, and not just credentials, but anything you want to keep safe across personal and business worlds. They're always improving this. They just rolled out a few new features. If you've heard me talk about Bitwarden and sing its praises, there's some new things. Password-protected encrypted export. So most password managers have ways to export your vault so you can go to another password manager, right? Or back it up, right? But there's a little flaw. Most of them export it in plain text. Hey, that's great for using if you just don't want any security, I guess. So now they've added encrypted exports. So this is for backup, obviously. So this is great. Or to share it with somebody or whatever, but that's a fantastic idea. They have this thing, a mobile username generator, right? Every password manager has a password generator. This will also generate a unique username, which is really cool. And it uses a number of different email providers, including mine, Fastmail. Three of the five aliases that Bitwarden supports. Mobile username generator is really fantastic because the bad guy would have to not only know your password, you have to know what the special username you're using. You can do DuckDuckGo email aliases. Support for that service has been integrated, bringing the number of support alias services now up to five. That's fantastic. So you can do it on mobile, by the way. That's the new thing. You can do it on your mobile device. DuckDuckGo macOS browser integration. Bitwarden partnered with DuckDuckGo. We love them, even though Steve hates the name. We love the service. To create an integration with the DuckDuckGo browser for Mac. We've talked about this before. So that's really cool. It's integrated into the browser. It's not an extension. This is a much more secure way to do it. Stay tuned for when they'll launch this feature. I mean, Bitwarden definitely has extensions for all the major browsers. I use it on Firefox, but I love the idea of it having it built into the browser as part of the entire browser service. I think that's a great idea. Bitwarden's great for individual users, free forever for individual users because it's open source. But they also have a number of business versions that I think are fantastic and include some features every business needs, like Bitwarden Send. So you're going to be doing your taxes in the next few months, right? How often does an accountant send you your tax returns? Oh, we're all done. Through the email. That's a terrible idea. Bitwarden Send uses fully encrypted method to transmit sensitive information. It can be text. It can be files. You can generate unique and secure passwords, of course, for every site with enterprise-grade security that's fully compliant. By the way, this is important, too. GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA, SOC 2 compliant. Now, there are different business tiers. There's the Teams organization option. That's $3 per month per user. The Enterprise Organization Plan, $5 a month per user. They'll allow you to share private data securely with coworkers across departments, the entire company. But as always with Bitwarden, you want to start with the basic free account, free forever, unlimited number of passwords on any platform. And that personal database, then you set that up and then you add the business database. So you get the best of both worlds. And for a business, by the way, that's a really important thing for us. We want our employees to not only use the password manager at work, we want them to use it everywhere for everything, including their personal stuff. So that's really nice. And I have the premium account just because I want to support them. That's it's less than a buck a month. I think it's $10 a year. It's nothing. There's also a family organization plan, $3.33 a month, and you get up to 6 users. So that's a really good deal too. Look, you got to use a password manager, right? But can I recommend the one I use, the one I love, the one I think is the best? Bitwarden, the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, at work. It's trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with it's free forever for individuals. No problem. But you can also get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan. Bitwarden.com/twit. Bitwarden.com/twit. You know what? If you're at all interested, just start with a free plan. I immediately started paying them $10 a year because I just think I want to get them to keep going. And it's a great enterprise solution too. Bitwarden.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of Mr. Gibson and Security Now. All right. Okay. I got a chart.
So the whole point of a pie chart,
yes,
is to show you visually,
yes,
the angles of the various slices of the pie. You know, I mean, the reason aircraft instrumentation and even our cars still use dials, like, you know, still have pointers, is that and a clock face, an analog clock face, is so powerful, is that it requires no interpretation, no figuring out what the numbers mean in order to get meaning from this. And it turned, you know, like they tried to go all digital in cockpits years ago, and it turns out that was not a good idea, because a pilot can instantly see the angle of needles as opposed to needing to interpret numbers.
Yeah.
So what happened last Tuesday during the election is that the various outlets could not resist doing this 3D thing to their pie charts. And they, in order to make it more fancy 3D, they accentuated the third dimension, creating this perspective. Well, so on today's picture of the week, it shows some, you know, a random exit poll with 5 different values, and the largest one is smaller looking than the next largest one. In order, you know, in this chart, green looks like it's, you know, like way more than 90 degrees, when in fact it's not. I mean, and it, you know, compared to the orange thing. Anyway, it's just, I know I've mentioned this before, but I saw this, I thought, oh, well, you know, come on, guys. Just, you know, give us angles which are, you know, a flat pie chart that we're looking down on from above, rather than like, oh, we're going to make this 3D and
but
fancy.
It's pretty, Steve.
Yeah.
It may be inaccurate, but it's pretty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I'm done with my rant on that. Last Tuesday was November's. Not only was it the midterm elections in the U.S., it was November's Patch Tuesday, We had security updates being released by Adobe, Microsoft, SAP, Android, VMware, Citrix, and others. You know, everybody sort of piled on, probably hoping to, like, not be seen as obviously if everyone does it on the same day. In the case of Microsoft, 67 security flaws were fixed. So, you know, on the high side, but not, you know, not 167. And among those were the two lingering so-called proxy not shell zero-day vulnerabilities, which have been continuing to plague those running on-site Exchange server installations. There were also another four actively exploited zero days fixed by last week's update. There was a remote code execution in the JScript 9 scripting language. The Google tag team found and reported that to Microsoft. And, you know, again, zero days, right? They were being exploited when they were discovered. There was a mark of the web bypass known as Zippy Reads, an elevation of privilege in the Windows print spooler service. We're still discovering problems with that. Microsoft found that one being exploited, and also an elevation of privilege in the Windows cryptographic number generation key isolation service, which, again, clever people are finding these problems and using them to elevate their privileges. Typically, obviously, bad people. So Microsoft found that being happening. However, amid all this, we did not get past this month's Patch Tuesday without the induction of some new headaches for enterprise admins. Since last Tuesday, Microsoft has been investigating the cause behind many reports and no doubt many quick rollbacks of the month's improvements to Windows, which affected enterprise domain controllers, which started experiencing Kerberos sign-in failures and other authentication problems. Well, we now know since Microsoft said we're investigating this, we know what's going on. After a little bit about Kerberos, after Windows 2000, Kerberos replaced the creaky and never quite ready for prime time homegrown NT LAN manager protocol. And, you know, we've discussed NTLM's many security problems through the years on this podcast. Kerberos was designed by MIT and was first released, interestingly, the year after I first published SpinRite. Yes, way back in 1988 was when Kerberos happened. So it's been around for 39 years. It's a bulletproof client-server mutual authentication protocol that works. Well, at least it did for Windows until last week. They're going to get it fixed, I'm sure. They've acknowledged the trouble by saying, this is Microsoft, after installing updates released on November 8th, 2022 or later on Windows servers with a domain controller role, you might have issues with Kerberos authentication, which is to say, you know, pretty much all authentication that the domain controllers are using. They said, when this issue is encountered, you might receive a Microsoft Windows Kerberos Key Distribution Center event, ID 14 error event, in the system section of event log on your domain controller with the below text. And as a consequence, here's what happens. Domain user sign-in might fail. This also might affect Active Directory Federation services authentication. Group managed services accounts used for services such as Internet Information Services, their IIS web server, might fail to authenticate. Remote desktop connections using domain users might fail to connect. Of course, you know, all of these mights are actually wills, right? You might be able, and we read this as you will be unable, to access shared folders on workstations and file shares on servers. Printing that requires domain user authentication might fail or, you know, will. Anyway, so, you know, this is the typical collapse that we are with increasing frequency seeing following the application of a monthly round of patches and improvements. Thanks to a listener, Johan Melberg, who tweeted about this, there's a Reddit thread that explains what happened. Now, the current best practice is to disable the use of the very old RC4 cipher for Kerberos. But November's trouble has hit those enterprises which did. So this suggests that Microsoft did not test their November changes under what is now well-established current best practices. I've got a link in the show notes to this Reddit thread for anyone who's interested and who would be affected by this. It documents the fixes to this, which have worked for all of those who have implemented them. So that might be useful to some of our listeners. We tell everyone, of course, that patching as soon as possible can often be critical. And we know that it can be, but it's also true, as we seem to keep seeing, that doing so might also cause major systemic failures throughout an organization. So it's no wonder that those whose jobs this is to deal with this are, you know, notoriously high stressed. Anyway, so a bunch of problems fixed, a bunch of 0 days fixed, a regression, which Microsoft will fix, I'm sure, and some workarounds. So your typical Patch Tuesday. This next bit of news falls under the category labeled "Not all things that can be done should be done." And we occasionally encounter those on the podcast. Unfortunately, a new smart host attack automation framework. Yes, a host attack automation framework was open sourced a week ago, last Tuesday, on GitHub. My first thought was, please don't make attacking hosts any easier for the script kiddies. But it's too late. A cybersecurity engineer by the name of Mazen Ahmed explained that back in 2019, he and a fellow researcher, Khalid Farah, participated in a security competition for developing offensive security tools, not defensive, offensive. And as we'll see a little bit later, these might be now of interest to Australia, but we'll get there in a minute. So Mazen wrote, he said, "I enjoy building security tools, and this competition was funded by HITB, that's Hack in the Box, with a reward of $100,000 for the winners. He says, I thought it would be an interesting challenge to work on as a side project. I met my friend Khalid. He was also interested in winning this competition. We signed up, and once accepted, we started meeting regularly to build this project." Okay, so the Hack in the Box Cyber Week AI Challenge, as it was called, had two categories: host exploitation or malware evasion. And unfortunately, they chose the host exploitation option. So he wrote, "Host exploitation sounds more relevant to our experience. The goal was to build a host exploitation framework using AI based on the concept of deep exploit. The winning team should ideally prove the accuracy of the model, the improvement of the training and execution speed, and the technical features that have been added to the framework. We started experimenting with deep exploit and how it works, and we decided to start a new project based on the ideas we had on how to improve that tool. This eventually ended up having us develop something that they named Shenina, S-H-E-N-N-I-N-A, Shenina, a host exploitation framework. He said, the project is 4 times faster than deep exploit. We were excited about the results. Shenina comes with a deception detection capability that detects if the machine being exploited is a virtual machine or container, and then terminates post-exploitation once it's detected. This feature is powered by Metasploit modules. The Shinina framework has qualified for the top 5 projects out of 40 that is in that competition. He said, we worked on developing the tool further to prepare for our final demo that will be live at HITB Abu Dhabi 2019. Okay, so that was, 3 years ago. He said, unfortunately, the rules of the competition and the judging criteria changed during the demo day, which I guess meant that they didn't do as well as they expected to. He said, we enjoyed HITB Cyber Week 2019. It was an amazing journey, and I enjoyed building the Shinina framework. I also presented my research on JWT hacking at the time. JWT is the abbreviation for Jason Web Tokens. And he says, it was a busy week. Finally, he said, we're planning to open source the project and the experiment. There are no plans for further maintaining Shinina in the near future. And that open sourcing of Shinina just came to pass. This powerful Shinina host exploitation framework is now up on GitHub. They do comment under the FAQ question. They ask themselves, why are we solving this problem with AI? And they reply, the problem should be solved by a hash tree without using AI. However, the HITB Cyber Week AI challenge required the project to find ways to solve it through AI. So that's what they did. So extracting some of the more interesting bits from the project's abstract, they explain, Shinina is an automated host exploitation framework. The mission of the project is to fully automate the scanning, vulnerability scanning and analysis, and exploitation using artificial intelligence. Shinina is integrated with Metasploit and Nmap for performing the attacks, as well as being integrated with an in-house command and control server for exfiltrating data from compromised machines automatically. And I'm thinking, and why post this tool publicly? Wow. Then they continue. Shinina scans a set of input targets for available network services, uses its AI engine to identify recommended exploits for the attacks, then attempts to test and attack the targets. If the attack succeeds, Shinina proceeds with the post-exploitation phase. The AI engine is initially trained against live targets to learn reliable exploits against remote services. Shinina also supports a heuristics mode for identifying recommended exploits. The documentation can be found in the docs directory within the project. And then they enumerate their features. Automated self-learning approach for finding exploits. High performance using managed concurrency design. Intelligent exploits clustering. Post-exploitation capabilities. Deception detection. Ransomware simulation capabilities. Automated data exfiltration. Vulnerability scanning mode, heuristic mode support for recommended exploits, Windows, Linux, and Mac OS support for agents, scriptable attack method with the post-exploitation phase, exploits suggestions for kernel exploits, out-of-band technique testing for exploitation checks, automated exfiltration of important data on compromised servers, reporting capabilities, coverage for 40-plus TTPs, that's, of course, tactics, techniques, and procedures, within the MITRE attack framework, and supports multi-input targets. Well, that's just great. It's bad enough. Really? I mean, do we have to be doing this? making this so easy for the script kiddies.
This is the excuse they always give. It's for pen testing. You know, it's to simplify your pen
testing.
That's
right. It's bad enough that the quite sophisticated and powerful Nmap scanner and Metasploit frameworks, both which have been developing and evolving over many years, already allow sophisticated hackers to scan network regions and exploit them. But now, this process has been automated with a somewhat smart front end that incorporates Nmap and Metasploit to create a turnkey, all-in-one automated system that could be launched by junior hackers who would never have the ability to create such a tool themselves. So, buckle up.
You think it's meant for malicious use, or I obviously do.
I just think, it's one of those things that just because you can doesn't mean you should. This will be of vastly more interest to script kiddies who say, oh, look, we download it and I run it on my Linux box.
Yeah.
And it just attacks everything.
It's
and
so
exploits
easy.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, you could also see how red teams need tools or would like tools like this.
Yes. So I'm sure that a red team could point it at their own network
right. And
discover useful things. Unfortunately, it also accepts the command line **.
Oh.
Which,
ow.
You know, put it on the internet and let it loose.
Yeah.
So,
yikes.
And the fact that it runs on Linux means that if you compromise routers, it'll, you know, routers are all Linux-based now. So just host this and start scanning and exploitating. Wow. Yeah. So again, it's you know, we've seen where there's a problem with people posting proofs of concepts to GitHub now because they're immediately weaponized. Well, now we've just weaponized Nmap and Metasploit, so you don't even have to read the manuals for them. You just press go. And unfortunately, people will. Wow.
Well,
you know, the only one thing we've seen, Leo, over and over is the only way to drive change is to force it to happen. So the upside is after a period of cataclysm, we may end up with stronger software as a consequence just because we didn't have a choice because, you know, these AI bots are now roaming around intelligently learning how to attack. Skynet, anyone? Wow. Okay. In happier news, GitHub has just added a new private vulnerability reporting feature. It allows security researchers to report vulnerabilities to which they have found in which exist in public repositories to their respective owners via a private channel for the first time. So in other words, this new feature will allow sensitive security-related reports to be filed to repo owners without having to file a publicly viewable entry in a repo's issues tracker.
They probably should have had that along. That's
that was my first thought was, oh, you're celebrating that in 2022?
Wow.
Why is this a new feature today? Yeah, this should have been done long ago. But I guess maybe it wasn't in keeping with the spirit. Again, this is, you know, we need some evolution of the spirit, right? And we're going to get that before long.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, there are presently 1.9 million unique instances of the Lightspeed web server providing services on the internet. Lightspeed is ranked 6th most popular web server, which gives it about a 2% share of all web servers globally. So it's not, you know, not a big name, but it's there. The problem is, after some research by Palo Alto Networks Unit 42, any additions of either the free and open source version, which is known as Open Lightspeed, or the enterprise version, which is just Lightspeed, which have not been updated in the past month, need to be patched immediately. So I'm bringing this to our listeners' attention because among them, I mean, I remember looking at Lightspeed when I was considering servers. It's a recently written, fast, fleet little server, but it's got some problems. The Unit 42 research team took a close look at the source code for Open Lightspeed, which, of course, is, as you are often telling us, Leo, and you're right, a big advantage of open source, right? There it is.
Yeah.
Researchers, if they're so inclined, can look at it and go, wait a minute, that doesn't look like a type safe, cast there and so forth. Anyway, the Unit 42 guys from Palo Alto Networks took a look at it and discovered three different vulnerabilities in the web server. The three vulnerabilities have been confirmed to similarly affect the non-open source enterprise version, which obviously is based on the same, code base, by chaining and exploiting the vulnerabilities. Adversaries can compromise the web server to gain fully privileged remote code execution, meaning, remote, like over across the internet. So there's the three vulnerabilities. There's a remote code execution, which is rated high severity with a CVSS of 8.8, and a privilege escalation, same, high severity, 8.8, and a directory traversal, which is given a medium severity of 5.8. A little over a month ago, Unit 42 responsibly disclosed their discovery of these three vulnerabilities to the server's publisher and their maintainer, known as Lightspeed Technologies, and even provided suggested remediation. Okay, that was on October 4th. In 2 weeks later, on the 18th, Lightspeed Technologies released their updates. So anyone using the open version from 1.5.11 through 1.7.16 needs to immediately update to 1.7.16.1. And Lightspeed versions 5.4.6 through 6.0.11 needs to immediately move to 6.0.12. Again, those were released on October 18th, not quite a month ago. So if this affects you, if you've got Lightspeed running and you haven't, and you don't know that you've updated in the last month, do it. There are 1.9 million of these in use. And since the fixes will be reflected in the open source version, bad guys will have no trouble seeing what was fixed and designing an exploit chain that Unit 42 warned of. Since the location of all Lightspeed web servers are known to Shodan and other internet scanners, these servers will be found. So don't delay. Okay, a really cool bit of news and of interest for Linux users. Last Thursday, the guys at Kudelski Security Research open sourced an interesting utility that I think will be of interest to our listeners. Here's how Kudelski explains their creation. They said, "Today, we are excited to release ShuffleCake, a tool aimed at helping people whose freedom of expression is threatened by repressive authorities or dangerous criminal organizations, in particular, whistleblowers, investigative journalists, and activists for human rights in oppressive regimes. ShuffleCake is FLOSS, free/libre open source software. Source code in C is available and released under the GNU General Public License 3 or superior." They explained, "ShuffleCake is a tool for Linux that allows the creation of multiple hidden volumes on a storage device in such a way that it is very difficult, even under forensic inspection, to prove the existence of such volumes. Each volume is encrypted with a different secret key, scrambled across the empty space of an underlying existing storage medium, and indistinguishable from random noise when not decrypted. Even in the presence of the ShuffleCake software itself, even if the presence of the ShuffleCake software itself cannot be hidden, and hence the presence of secret volumes is suspected, the number of volumes is also hidden. This allows a user to create a hierarchy of plausible deniability, where most hidden secret volumes are buried under less hidden decoy volumes, whose passwords can be surrendered under pressure. In other words, a user can plausibly lie to a coercive adversary about the existence of hidden data by providing a password that unlocks decoy data. Every volume can be managed independently as a virtual block device. In other words, you know, partitioned, formatted with any file system of choice, and mounted and dismounted like a normal disk. The whole system is very fast, with only a minor slowdown in I/O throughput compared to a bare LUKS encrypted disk, and with negligible waste of memory and disk space. And I love this. They said, you can consider ShuffleCake a spiritual successor of tools such as TrueCrypt and VeraCrypt, but vastly improved. First of all, it works natively on Linux. It supports any file system of choice and can manage up to 15 nested volumes per device, making deniability of the existence of these partitions highly plausible. So, for anyone who's interested, look at shufflecake.net, shufflecake.net, and you'll find all the information
there. Yeah, it looks really good. For plausible deniability. I love that.
Yeah, they did a beautiful job.
Yeah.
And Leo, I'm going to take a sip of water while you tell us about our second sponsor.
Okay.
Then we're going to talk about Australia deciding to take the gloves off. Woo!
Yeah, this will be interesting. Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN. Yeah, this is, I love this because our advertisers know who listens to Security Now, and they know you're security focused. We did Bitwarden, a password manager. Now let's talk about VPNs. I don't think I need to explain to you, understand what a VPN does. It does, well, three things primarily. One is, of course, it protects your security by encrypting everything coming out of your computer in an encrypted tunnel between you and the VPN server, where it emerges into the public on the public internet. It also protects your privacy by doing that. So it's security, but also privacy, because your ISP and nobody along the way can see what you're doing. And that's important too. And of course, finally, it gives you geographic mobility. You can appear on the internet pretty much anywhere you want with ExpressVPN, because they have servers all over the world. You get your choice. And what's nice about ExpressVPN, they have a nice app. It's just a big button. You turn it on. Windows, Mac, Linux, iOS, Android. You can even put on some routers. They have their own router now they started selling that is an ExpressVPN router. You turn it on, it's going to automatically choose the best server for you in terms of speed. But let's say you want to go to England so you can watch UK Netflix. Well, then you click another button that says, you know, I want to be in London. Then start it, and now you're in London. You know what a VPN does. One thing I want to point out, you know, probably most of you are sophisticated enough to create your own VPN. I know Steve does. That doesn't give you the geographic mobility. It's somewhat limited, because if you VPN, let's say, back to your house where you're running the server, your ISP sees the stuff emerging from your house. So it also limits the privacy thing. It's really only good for the first part, the security if you're an open Wi-Fi access point, something like that. ExpressVPN gives you all three, because you're using a third-party provider. Now, the big caveat, you've got to trust the third-party provider, because they have access to all the stuff your internet service provider would have otherwise, because you're going through them. That's where it becomes decrypted. And this is why I use ExpressVPN, and we recommend ExpressVPN. They go the extra mile to make sure there is no information about you on the ExpressVPN servers. And they, by the way, they get this audited regularly, so by an independent third party. So, and you can see those audit reports at expressvpn.com/security now. They use, if there was a good article on Bleeping Computer about 6 months ago, you could see that they use a special version of Debian that refreshes itself every reboot. So it wipes the drive, reinstalls, starts from scratch, and they do that every day. Plus, when you're on the server, they have a special server technology, they call it Trusted Server, that loads into RAM, is sandboxed in memory, and then as soon as you leave the server, it goes away. No traces left behind. We know this not only because of the audits, which say all of these things are true. We also know it because there are countries like Turkey where they don't serve warrants. They don't subpoena information. They just show up at the door and they take the server. And this has happened in many countries. It happened in Turkey not so long ago. What did they find on that ExpressVPN server? Nothing. No information about customers. Nothing. It's proof. ExpressVPN protects your privacy. And with ISPs selling your data to data brokers, your information about your location on your phone being sold, going to the IRS, going to the Department of Homeland Security, we just learned that they buy big tranches of data from these data brokers. I think it's nice to know those snoops cannot snoop. Mask your digital footprints. I protect myself and you should too with ExpressVPN. When you connect it to ExpressVPN, your IP address is hidden, right? Now, this is important. Also, ExpressVPN is not free. I wouldn't actually recommend a free VPN because it costs money to have servers all over the world. It costs money to have sufficient bandwidth for those servers to be fast enough so you don't feel like you're going through mud. ExpressVPN is fast enough that you can watch HD video. You can watch those Doctor Who episodes in full HD and in 4K, and there's no slowdown. But also, and this is a little bit more subtle, they also rotate their IP addresses. One of the things that does happen with many VPNs, the IP addresses become associated with that VPN because that becomes your IP address when you exit the VPN server. And that's how BBC iPlayer and others block VPNs, is they know, oh, that's a VPN IP address. ExpressVPN assiduously rotates and moves and buys new blocks of IP addresses so that they never become identified as, oh yeah, he's on ExpressVPN. That's even more privacy for you. Put it on your phone, your computer, on your router. Turn it on with one button. You're protected. Turn it off anytime you want or leave it on. It's so fast, you'll never notice. In fact, I've often left it on by accident, forgetting that I had it on. I did a whole show on with the iPad with ExpressVPN turned on, and after the show, I went, oh, this whole time I've had ExpressVPN turned on. Make sure your online activity and data is protected. The best VPN money can buy. And it's not expensive, by the way. Yes, you're paying for it, but it's less than $7 a month. When you use our special link, you get 3 months free with a one-year package, less than $7 a month. That's your best deal. ExpressVPN.com/security now. Another reason I love them, they spell Express, E-X-P-R-E-S-S. No vowels dropped. ExpressVPN.com/security now. Check it out. If you've been looking for a VPN provider you can trust again and again, it's been ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN.com/security now. We thank them so much for supporting Steve's efforts. I have your video ready, Steve.
So, good. Earlier, I mentioned that Australia might have an interest in offensive as opposed to purely defensive cyber weaponry. As we previously noted here, Australia has been recently having, you know, more than their share of problems with cyber attacks. They've had a slew of them, and they're apparently getting a bit tired of them. So the straw that may have broken the camel's back is the most recent ransomware attack on an Australian private insurance provider named Medibank. Medibank said that attackers broke into their network, stole internal files, including sensitive personal and healthcare details on 9.7 million Australians, then encrypted their files and demanded a ransom. When Medibank refused to pay, the ransomware gang, going by the name of BlogXX, although believed to be a spinoff of Revil, began leaking some of MetaBank's patient records to intimidate MetaBank and create public pressure to pay the ransom. One of the group's first leaks was a file named Abortions. Not surprisingly, the Blog XX group's actions have galvanized the Australian government, and Australia has now vowed to go on the offensive. The group's activities have been met with outrage and significant political attention from the highest levels of the Australian government. Okay, so Claire O'Neill is an Australian minister for Home Affairs, and she's the Minister of Cybersecurity. She was interviewed last week by ABC Insider and posted her 2.5-minute discussion to Twitter. So here's what Claire had to say.
Mark Dreyfus and I announced with the Deputy Prime Minister yesterday that we're setting up a permanent standing operation, a partnership of new policing between the Australian Signals Directorate, which are the cyber guns of the Australian Public Service, and the Australian Federal Police. This is an entirely new model of operating for these two organisations. What they will do is scour the world, hunt down the criminal syndicates and gangs who are targeting Australia in cyber attacks, and disrupt their efforts. This is Australia standing up and punching back. We are not going to sit back while our citizens are treated like this way and allow there to be no consequences for that.
Okay, just to be clear though, this task force has been in place for a while though, hasn't it?
No, that's incorrect. Okay. So this is a new operation, a permanent standing force of 100 of the best, most capable cyber experts in this country that will be undertaking this task for the first time, offensively attacking these people, David. So this is not a model of policing where we wait for a crime to be committed and then try to understand who it is and do something to the people who are responsible. We are offensively going to find these people, hunt them down, and debilitate them before they can attack our country.
What's your expectation here of what they'll be able to achieve? Because, you know, we know whether it's in this new standing operation or in you know, their previous task forces, they've been trying for a while to go after these hackers. The Americans have for years. They did manage to arrest a few of them about a year ago. What's your expectation about what they'll realistically be able to achieve?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a perception in the community that it's hard to do anything about cyber attacks, and that's actually wrong. There's an enormous amount that we can do. I think we need to shift away from the sense that the only good outcome here is someone behind bars, because that can be hard when we've got people who are essentially being harboured by foreign governments and allowed to continue this type of activity. But what we can do is two really important things. The first thing is hunt these people down and disrupt their operations. It weakens these groups if governments like ours collaborate with the FBI and other police forces and intelligence agencies around the world. But the second important thing that we need to do is stand up and say that Australia is not going to be a soft target for this sort of thing. And if people come after our citizens, we are going to go after them.
I don't think this... legal, right? I mean, you can't pursue people before they commit the crime, for one thing.
I know. I mean, this is like, what?
Very Australian. So, very Australian.
Yeah. Well, so her statement was released the same day that the Australian Federal Police issued a statement formally identifying the MetaBank hackers as being located in Russia, which, you know, comes as a surprise to no one. Australian Federal Police Commissioner Rhys Kershaw said in his statement, he said, quote, "We believe we know which individuals are responsible, but will not be naming them. What I will say is that we'll be holding talks with Russian law enforcement about these individuals." And, you know, despite an explosion in ransomware attacks, as we noted last week, more than $1.2 billion in payments made in 2021 alone, the cases where law enforcement agencies fought back and hacked the hackers have been rare. There have been a few success stories, such as the DOJ, you know, the U.S. Department of Justice, managing to recover the Colonial Pipeline payments that was made to the DarkSide Group. And both U.S. Cybercom and the FBI hacked Reval's servers following the Kaseya-based attacks. In both cases, DarkSide and Reval's operations were shut down following these proactive, potentially, I guess, offensive operations. And these effective responses did appear to give attackers at least a bit of pause. Yet the problem obviously persisted and persists. So it's going to be very interesting to see what might come from Australia's new, you know, we're not going to take this lying down anymore stance. But, you know, exactly as you said, Leo, until now, the bad guys have had the advantage that they don't care about breaking cyber intrusion laws, whereas global governments have been hampered by their need to play by the rules and act within the law. So, you know, what does Australia exactly mean when they say they're going to be going after the bad guys and disrupt them? You know, are they going to break cyber intrusion laws to get that done? I guess we'll see.
Hmm.
Wow.
She may have misunderstood exactly what they were going to be doing. Well,
I don't know, because, I mean, he sort of pushed back and she pushed back on him.
Yeah. Wow.
So anyway, they did celebrate Metabank's decision to not capitulate to the demands of its attackers. And separately, O'Neill suggested that the government might look into a law which formally bans payments made to ransomware and data extortion attackers altogether, with the hope that this would strangle the financial incentive behind those attacks. Yeah. Like, you know, you're not going to get any money out of anyone you attack in Australia, so go to attack other people. Again,
I understand the outrage.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's infuriating, but...
I know,
but
you can't be a vigilante.
Yeah, you can't. No.
So, Apple iOS. What observers are saying looks like Apple capitulating to the demands from China. The latest iOS 16.1.1, and also in the next beta of 16.2, have added a new timeout to the AirDrop sharing feature, which limits the share with everyone option to 10 minutes. The reason Chinese influence is suspected is that for the time being, at least, this only affects iPhones purchased in China. This new restriction is tied to the hardware. On the other hand, it's also worth noting that many people outside of China have celebrated the addition of this restriction as an extremely useful security improvement, since inadvertently leaving everyone sharing on, you know, enabled, could represent a significant security risk. And interestingly, this is not the first time Apple has customized some aspects of their iPhone offerings for China. In researching this a bit, I learned, believe it or not, that the Taiwanese flag emoji is not available on iPhones sold in China. Talk about petty. Anyway, Apple also uses the hardware tied method to limit the volume level of its devices within the EU, as is required by the laws there. So in the case of this 10-minute time limit, the motivation appears to be due to the fact that Chinese protesters had been using the feature to spread posters in opposition to Xi Jinping and the Chinese government. And for those who think that this is a useful feature, Bloomberg reported that Apple does have plans to make this new AirDrop option available globally next year, though presumably optional as opposed to mandatory, where it is now in China. So, you know, again, you know, we've seen that these global companies, whether it's Apple or Google or whomever, you know, if they want to operate within, you know, other countries that have different regulations, they need to alter their behavior if they want to stay there. Okay, a couple of decentralized finance notes that I couldn't help with, because these are just, again, it must be that by now our listeners understand where not to put their money. The DeFi platform Pando said it was the target of a hack Saturday before last, when a threat actor attempted to steal more than $70 million worth of cryptocurrency from the platform's wallets. Pando said that it managed to hold on to $50 million of the attempted stolen funds, but the attacker successfully stole more than $21.8 million of its funds. They said that the hacker used an Oracle attack against one of its protocols, and that they're still hoping to negotiate with the attacker to return some of the stolen funds, to which apparently the proper response is, well, you can hope. I wondered whether that had happened, since now that's been 10 days. So far, it doesn't appear the case. I found Pando's Twitter thread where they had announced the hack of their system. Then over the course of several days, they followed the stolen funds as they were anonymously moved from one currency or exchange to another. You know, this is just a mess. Imagine watching nearly $22 million of your dollars moving around and being able to do nothing about it. Such is the world we're in today. Also, the DeFi platform DFX Finance suffered a crypto heist, reporting the loss of $4.185 million worth of cryptocurrency assets following an attack on its platform last week. The company said the incident was identified as a, here's a new one, a reentrancy attack, which sounds like another of those increasingly common, oh, shoot, we failed to consider that possibility when we were designing our platform. You know, there went more than $4 million. So anyway, as I said, I'm sure everyone who follows the podcast by now knows that no one should rely upon what over and over again appear to be half-baked, poorly conceived, decentralized finance systems. And it clearly doesn't matter how well-intended the creators and the operators of these systems are. And remember the famous Willie Sutton quote, you know, where he explained that the reason he robbed banks was because that's where the money was. For many people, money is the great motivator. That's the singular thing that's driving the ransomware attacks today. They could care less about anyone's data. That's of no interest to them. They want money. And these DeFi systems are apparently sloshing around in way more money than they are responsible enough to manage. So, yeah, don't put yours there. A little bit of miscellany. It turns out that a product which was a past sponsor of Twit and of this Security Now podcast, The Helm, was unable to survive changes resulting from COVID-19. They recently announced that they would be unable to continue operating past the end of the year. So they provided their users with 60 days notice, so November and December, and have already stopped accepting new subscriptions. They explained that in 2019, they had relocated their production operations from Mexico to China in order to improve their scalability and began to work on a version 2 system. But then COVID hit, and their scheduling times more than doubled. I'm bringing this up here for two reasons. First, anyone who had obtained their own domain that was hosted at Helm's registrar, you may wish to move it to somewhere else if you want to hold on to it, you know, like I would suggest Hover, my own registrar, before they also became a Twit sponsor. So current users will have only until the end of this year to get their domain moved, but the Helm is, you know, fully supporting that movement and will work with any of their current users to do so. The second reason I'm mentioning this is that on their FAQ page, in response to the question, what can I do with the Helm server after you shut down? They wrote, we are working on a firmware update for Helm servers to be converted to Linux servers running Armbian. We will provide documentation for this conversion, along with pointers to some guides for running mail and file sharing services if you would like to continue using your Helm. We expect this firmware update to be available in early to mid-December. So I've got a link here in the show notes to the support page about this happening, about Helm shutting down. So, you know, just a heads up to anyone listening that if you are a Helm user, some action will need to be taken between now and the end of the year. I would imagine you'll want to, you know, keep your eye out for this firmware update to your device that would make it freely useful elsewhere.
Yeah, I think they're doing the best they can.
Yeah.
They were hit by supply chain shortages and so forth. I know the guys. They're great people, and they're just trying to do the best thing they can. You won't be an email server anymore because serving your own email is not something for the faint of heart. It's very difficult to do from a home network. It's even for us, it'd be difficult to do because of the fact that Gmail, the big mail companies, just don't want to hear from you. They'll just black hole you like that. So, but at least you'll be able to use it for something. And it's a cool, I still have mine. It's a cool little thing. I'll put this, what is it? Armbian.
Right. Okay, so Elon meets Twitter. There's no way for a weekly podcast to possibly follow the insanity that has befallen Twitter, ever since Elon has taken the reins. But one of our listeners, Ed Ross, put me onto a Twitter thread from yesterday that gave me a chuckle, which I thought our listeners would appreciate. So Elon says, he announced yesterday, part of today will be turning off the microservices bloatware. He says less than 20% are actually needed for Twitter to work, exclamation point.
And then, of course, the engineers who said, Elon, you don't understand how it works, were fired immediately. Uh-huh.
Yes, exactly. And after the results of pulling those plugs resulted in a new catastrophe du jour, someone named Zach Silverberg tweeted, he said, apparently they didn't turn off two-factor authentication, but they did turn off the service that sends you the two-factor authentication code. So if you log out and try to log in with an authentication code, you simply won't receive one.
Well, first of
all, thank you, Elon.
You should have turned off SMS authentication a long time ago.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the way two-factor, and you know, I went through this a couple of years ago on Twitter, the way two-factor works on Twitter, you have to turn it on first, but they give you two other methods, an authenticator app like Google Authenticator or hardware key. And once you get the others set up, you can uncheck, as I did, the SMS. So if you didn't do that, if you only had SMS, I don't know what you're going to do now. Don't log out. The other thing, Ed Butt did a good article on what to do now, because Twitter security is clearly going to fail. He suggested, and I think he's right, to immediately go to your Twitter account and turn off all the third-party apps you've enabled. Most of us over the years have, you know, turned on a variety of tools, maybe even log in with Twitter and stuff. For instance, I get into Medium by logging in with Twitter, so Medium shows up there. Given that we don't know what the security status of Twitter is going to be going forward, disconnect those.
Very, very
right?
good point.
Just disconnect all of those. So I did that. Turn off two-factor with SMS, but make sure you have two-factor on, because and then others are saying maybe you want to delete your DMs. Those are not encrypted. And if you had anything in there that you thought was private, maybe you should get rid of it now. It's inevitable at this point that it's going to slowly start to crumble. And the first thing that's going to go is security. So you'd be wise. I mean, if you want to stay on there, that's fine. But if you'd be wise to, you know, give it nothing that you don't want to lose.
What a mess.
Oh, it's such a mess. It's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Daniel Smith, a listener, he said, this could be a new SN, as in, you know, Security Now saying. And then he quoted somebody on Twitter named Lewis Locklock, who replied to someone else. And I do love this quote. There's nothing more permanent than a temporary solution.
That's true. You know that. You had a fix that you forgot you did, right? Ages
that's
ago
right.
to your server.
That's exactly right. You're right. I overrode DNS for my e-commerce. And then when they change their IP. Whoops. I stopped being able to accept payments. It's like, whoops. Yeah. Dennis Keefe, financial coach, he tweeted, "Hi, Steve. Wanted to let you know the sponsor link for Drata seems to send you to a 404. I'd hate for y'all to lose money. Love the show." And so I went. I mean, I tried drata.com/twit, and sure enough, it 404s. So I just thought, Leo, mostly for your benefit.
Okay. That I would
note that.
Go to, they're a sponsor. Go to twit.tv/sponsors, and there should be a link on there to any sponsor. And if the one that we told you doesn't work, let me click drata.com/twit. We're at error 404. So I will, whoops. Wait a minute. No, yep. Yeah, it says things got out of control there. Automate compliance and risk management control passed. Find this page. Control failed. okay, I'll go. I'll be taking a walk right. Well, no, after I do the next ad, because I know you're getting close, I will take a walk down to continuity and alert them.
So,
and
thank you, Dennis. Thank you for the pointer.
I appreciate that, yeah. And by the way, if you want to tweet me, don't do it on Twitter. Do it on twit.social, our Mastodon instance.
There we go.
Yeah.
Neil Baldridge tweeted, "Hi, Steve. Just a quick thank you for passing along your recommendation for the Silver Ship series." He says, I'm just into book 6 and finding the stories to be a great read. I'm trying to pace myself, but without much success. It's so nice to find an extensive series that's so enjoyable." And so I'll just take this opportunity to note that I totally agree. The series author, Scott Yuha, suggests that after finishing book 13, the reader should switch over to the 4-book Pyreans series. So that's what I did. I'm nearly finished with those 4 books. I'm more than halfway through the 4th of that 4-book series. So I can attest that they are every bit as delicious as the Silver Ships series. Those 4 books trace the history of an entirely different Earth-descended colony, and its characters are every bit as interesting and alive as those in the Silver Ships. And what's intriguing is that by this point, the reader will have grown to intimately know 2 very different groups of human colonists, and Scott has explained that the 2 threads are going to be merging once the reader resumes with the Silver Ships series in book 14. You know, I've come to know this diverse set of characters so well that I cannot wait to see what he has in store for them when they meet. It promises to be quite cool. So anyway, I'm glad that a lot of our listeners have picked up and are enjoying that series. Timo Kieft tweeted, "Hey, Steve, I just wanted to respond to the whole OpenSSL debacle. You mentioned not many web servers accept client certs. This is not the case, though. Web servers serving big sites accept client certs because CDNs and DDoS protection services like Cloudflare use a client cert to assert their identity to web servers they proxy. This feature is used to ensure that the server only responds to requests provided through Cloudflare. Cloudflare calls this feature authenticated origin pulls." So thank you, Timo. That certainly makes sense as a reason for web servers to solicit and accept client certs. I guess I still doubt that the number is huge, but I agree that it would definitely be another reason for some increased vulnerability to the recent OpenSSL version 3 flaw. And of course, it would be those servers that would be accepting client certs because they were being served by CDNs and DDoS protectors that are probably worth attacking. So that's a very good point. And finally, Nariman Agategayev, sorry about your the way I pronounced your name. He said, "Dear Steve, after listening to episode 289, whoa, sorry, episode 892.
You're just a little dyslexic. It's okay.
Dyslexic much? Yeah. Episode 892, he said, "I decided to replace my Raspberry Pi home VPN server with a Zima board, which I ordered online right away. Following getting started instructions from the Casa OS, I created a new user and a complex password using its web UI on port 80. But I was quite concerned when I noticed that the credentials set are only for the Casa web application. The board came with more than 10 default users on its Debian OS, which still had their default passwords after the initial configuration steps. He says, I could log in over SSH using Casa OS for username and password. The root's default password is also Casa OS. There are no warnings or instructions on the Zima board and Casa OS websites about how to remove default users and passwords from the board. He said, I'm very concerned that if those boards are installed as a router, according to this article, and he provided a link, anyone will be able to SSH to it if owners don't proactively delete all Debian users. Thank you for your podcasts. You're an active listener for a few years already. So I wanted to share that because that's definitely a big heads up that would be important if somebody were using the Zima board, not as I am, to run SpinRite and to develop SpinRite, but, you know, using it as a pfSense router and like an exposing SSH publicly where it's got the default Casa OS username and password. So thank you very much for sending that to my attention.
Yeah, that's nasty.
Yeah. And boy, they really absolutely should make a note, you know, or like the setup system should change username and password for all of those other users and not leave them, not only change them for the login to the web UI and leave all of the other ones alone. In a quick update about SpinRite, it's all but finished. I'm getting very, very close to the first pre-release alpha of 6.1. I ended up rewriting a bunch of the command line parser to make drive selection extremely flexible and powerful. Then, as I had planned, I implemented the final verification for SpinRite by arranging to take a hash of an entire drive over which SpinRite had been run in order to absolutely verify that not a single bit had been changed across all of SpinRite's various machinations with a drive. And I discovered, to my surprise, that my AHCI driver would, in a very low but non-zero percentage of 16 megabyte transfers, occasionally not properly read the drive's data. To make sure this wasn't the, like, I had just written this code, so to make sure that it wasn't the brand new hashing system that was at fault for this, I tried the same thing with an IDE drive using SpinRite's also new bus mastering DMA driver, and that worked perfectly. So I know that my confidence testing code is working and that the new bus mastering driver is also working perfectly, but not so yet the new AHCI driver. This just happened on Sunday evening and also a little bit yesterday morning. So, you know, before I switched to working on the podcast, so I haven't had a second yet to dig into any of this. My guess is that something is going on with my end of transfer status testing, where I might be shutting down the controller before it's completely finished having transferred everything into RAM. Since it's transferring data asynchronously in the background using DMA, it's definitely necessary to make sure that it's finished. The good news is, thanks to now being able to take a hash of everything SpinRite reads, I'm able to test that quickly and verify any fixes that I make and changes. So anyway, I'm anxious to get back to it there as I will tonight to see what's going on. And I expect to be able to say next week that I am finished with this round of SpinRite development and that it's currently in alpha testing. So very, cool. Very close. Cool. And I'm very excited.
Yay.
And Leo?
Yes.
Tell us who our third sponsor. I'm going to wet my vocal cords, and then we're going to talk about memory safe language.
I'm very interested in this because, as you know, I like garbage collection. It's just me, but I like it. So we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But first, a word from Grammarly. First of all, they don't put this in their copy. I just want to say it. Grammarly is an amazing company, and there's two reasons behind the scenes I love them. One is they use Lisp, the original artificial intelligence language, not for everything, but I'm told their back end is Lisp. Two, they're in Ukraine, and under the most difficult of circumstances, continue to do the best software out there. So I'm a fan. I'm a Grammarly stan. I can give you a bunch of other reasons why I use Grammarly, and you should use Grammarly. Grammarly is not grammar checking. It sounds like it is. It's not spell checking. It's a whole lot. It's communication checking. When it comes to work, communication is key. I always told my kids, learn to write, because no matter what your job is, being able to write is critical because that's how you communicate. Even if you don't have a writing job, you have to write emails, reports, tweets, whatever. Grammarly works everywhere I just mentioned, everywhere you're working. So every important project not only gets done on time, but gets done clearly and communicates exactly what you intended to communicate. Grammarly has a free tier and they have a premium tier. Let me tell you about the premium tier. Their advanced tone suggestions in Grammarly Premium are awesome. They can help you reframe your communication to be more productive, more positive, to get everyone on the same page. I have a good friend who is a manager, and sometimes their emails are a little bit sharp and to the point because they're busy, they're managing, but they use Grammarly. And when Grammarly says, you know, you might want to just put a little sugar on that, and tells you how, they do it, and it makes a big difference. In fact, I even hear them. Sometimes I hear them say, but mostly I hear them say, thank you, Grammarly. It lets you reframe negative language to be more solution-focused. And because it's not a person over your shoulder, your spouse or what have you, telling you, you know, you might want to nicen that up. It's easier to take, right? Because it's just a program. But it says, hey, you know, you could put it this way, and it might be more effective. And it is. It is. Let's think about this. The bottom line of all of our communications is to communicate our ideas and to get the other person to go along, right? Grammarly helps you get that done. It makes your ideas clearer, and it makes it easier for your coworkers to say, yeah, that's a great idea. Grammarly Premium's tone suggestions will take you. It's not that you're not a good writer. I'm not saying that, but they'll take your professional writing to the next level and make you more effective as a leader, as a communicator, as a team member. Grammarly has a lot of other great features. It's got advanced spelling. Yes, it does have grammar. Yes. Punctuation is a big one. Okay. And I'm just going to be honest with you. I use Grammarly, but I also judge. When I see somebody spelling you're wrong or putting a comma where one does not belong or leaving out a comma where one does belong, I judge. We all do. We all say, well, okay. Grammarly will keep you from making those mistakes because they're just often. They're just because you're going fast. They're typos, whatever. You know better, but it helps you do better. And conciseness suggestions, too, which are great, to ensure your writing's professional, mistake-free, and clear. Paul Theroux, professional writer, really good writer. He uses Grammarly because it helps him be even better. Oh, and he likes, and I do too, the emails we get every week saying, this is, you know, this is what all the words you typed, how many letters, words, you know, how many, it's great. Just the stats alone. The right tone, getting it right, communicating it properly can move any project forward. Get it right with Grammarly. Grammarly's the best. And these are great people making a product that gets better all the time. Grammarly. Grammarly.com/tone. Oh, I like that. I like that. It's a special URL. But they know it's from our ad. So you use that, please, so that Steve gets credit. Grammarly.com/tone. You can download and learn more about Grammarly Premium's advanced tone suggestions. You could try Grammarly. They even have a text box on the page. You could paste something in just to see what Grammarly would do with it. I think it's fantastic. GRAMMARLY.com/tone to test out Grammarly's advanced tone suggestions. It's a subtle thing that can make a huge difference in your writing. Grammarly.com/tone. And you know, honestly, in tweets too. In fact, Elon, maybe you want to look at this. Grammarly.com/tone. Sometimes just a little slight shift in the tone can make all the difference. All right, Steve, let's talk about memory.
Okay.
It is the number one problem, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like 70% of the vulnerabilities are caused by mismanagement of memory. So what I'm going to share verbatim is what our National Security Agency, the NSA, published in an effort to improve security across the board. So they said at the beginning, there's a short executive summary. They said modern society relies heavily on software-based automation, implicitly trusting developers to write software that operates in the expected way and cannot be compromised for malicious purposes. While developers often perform rigorous testing to prepare the logic and software for surprising conditions, exploitable software vulnerabilities are still frequently based on memory issues. Examples include overflowing a memory buffer and leveraging issues with how software allocates and deallocates memory. Microsoft revealed at a conference in 2019 that from 2006 through 2018, 70% of their vulnerabilities were due to memory safety issues. Google also found a similar percentage of memory safety vulnerabilities over several years in Chrome. Malicious cyber actors can exploit these vulnerabilities for remote code execution or other adverse effects, which can also often compromise a device and be the first step in large-scale network intrusions. Commonly used languages such as C and C++ provide a lot of freedom and flexibility in memory management while relying heavily on the programmer to perform the needed checks on memory references. Simple mistakes can lead to exploitable memory-based vulnerabilities. Software analysis tools can detect many instances of memory management issues, and operating environment options can also provide some protection. But inherent protections offered by memory-safe software languages can prevent or mitigate most memory management issues. Okay, so that sets it up. Here's how they elaborate on this. NSA recommends using a memory-safe language when possible. While the use of added protections to non-memory-safe languages and the use of memory-safe languages do not provide absolute protection against exploitable memory issues, they do provide considerable protection. Therefore, the overarching software community across the private sector, academia, and the U.S. government have begun initiatives to drive the culture of software development towards using memory-safe languages. How a software program manages memory is core to preventing many vulnerabilities and ensuring a program is robust. Exploiting poor or careless memory management can allow a malicious cyber actor to perform nefarious acts, such as crashing the program at will or changing the instructions of the existing program to do whatever the actor desires. Even unexploitable issues with memory management can result in incorrect program results, degradation of the program's performance over time, or seemingly random crashes. Memory safety is a broad category of issues related to how a program manages memory. One common issue is called a buffer overflow, where data is accessed outside the bounds of an array. Other common issues relate to memory allocation. Languages can allocate new memory locations as a program is executing and then deallocate the memory, also called releasing or freeing the memory, later when the memory is no longer needed. But if this is not done carefully by the developer, new memory may be allocated again and again as the program executes. Consequently, memory is not always freed when it is no longer needed, resulting in a memory leak that could cause the program to eventually run out of available memory. Due to logic errors, programs can also attempt to use memory that has already been freed, or even free memory that has already been freed. Another issue can arise when languages allow the use of a variable that has not been initialized, resulting in the variable using the value that was previously set at that location in memory. Finally, another challenging issue is called a race condition. The issue can occur when a program's results depend on the order of execution of two parts of the program accessing the same data. All of these memory issues are much too common occurrences. By exploiting these areas of memory issues, malicious actors, who are not bound by normal expectations of software use, may find that they can enter unusual inputs into the program, causing memory to be accessed, written, allocated, or deallocated in unexpected ways. In some cases, a malicious actor can exploit these memory management mistakes to access sensitive information, execute unauthorized code, or cause other negative impacts. Since it may take a lot of experimenting with unusual inputs to find one that causes an unexpected response, actors may use a technique called fuzzing to either randomly or intelligently craft multitudes of input values to the program until one is found that causes the program to crash. Advances in fuzzing tools and techniques have made finding problematic inputs easier for malicious actors in recent years. Once an actor discovers that they can crash the program with a particular input, they examine the code and work to determine what a specially crafted input could do. In the worst case, such an input could allow the actor to take control of the system on which the program is running. Using a memory-safe language can help prevent programmers from introducing certain types of memory-related issues. Memory is managed automatically as part of the computer language. It does not rely on the programmer adding code to implement memory protections. The language institutes automatic protections using a combination of compile time and runtime checks. These inherent language features protect the programmer from introducing memory management mistakes unintentionally. Examples of memory-safe languages include C#, Go, Java, Ruby, Rust, and Swift. Even with a memory-safe language, memory management is not entirely memory-safe. Most memory-safe languages recognize the software sometimes needs to perform an unsafe memory management function to accomplish certain tasks. As a result, classes or functions are available that are... Are available that are recognized as non-memory-safe and allow the programmer to perform a potentially unsafe memory management task. Some languages require anything memory unsafe to be explicitly annotated as such to make the programmer and any reviewers of the program aware that it is unsafe. Memory safe languages can also use libraries written in non-memory safe languages and thus can contain unsafe memory functionality. Although these ways of including memory unsafe mechanisms subvert the inherent memory safety, they help to localize where memory problems could exist, allowing for extra scrutiny on those sections of code. Languages vary in their degree of memory safety instituted through inherent protections and mitigations. Some languages provide only relatively minimal memory safety, whereas other languages are very strict and provide considerable protections by controlling how memory is allocated, accessed, and managed. For languages with an extreme level of inherent protection, considerable work may be needed to simply get the program to compile due to checks and protections. Memory safety can be costly in performance and flexibility. Most memory-safe languages require some sort of garbage collection to reclaim memory that has been allocated but is no longer needed by the program. There's also considerable performance overhead associated with checking the bounds on every array access that could potentially be outside of an array. Alternatively, a similar performance hit can exist in a non-memory safe language due to the checks a programmer adds to the program to perform bounds checking and other memory management protections. Additional costs of using non-memory safe languages include hard-to-diagnose memory corruption and occasional program crashes, along with the potential for exploitation of memory access vulnerabilities. It is not trivial to shift a mature software development infrastructure from one computer language to another. Skilled programmers need to be trained in a new language, and there is an efficiency hit when using a new language. Programmers must endure a learning curve and work their way through any newbie mistakes. While another approach is to hire programmers skilled in a memory-safe language, they too will have their own learning curve for understanding the existing code base and the domain in which the software will function. Now, here's something that we've never talked about before, but I think it's an important thing to mention here. They say several mechanisms can be used to harden non-memory-safe languages to make them more memory safe. Analyzing the software using static and dynamic application security testing, abbreviated SAST for static application security testing, and DAST for dynamic application security testing, can identify memory use issues in software. Static analysis examines the source code to find potential security issues. Using SAST allows all of the code to be examined, but it can generate a considerable number of false positives through identifying potential issues incorrectly. However, SAST can be used throughout the development of the software, allowing issues to be identified and fixed early in the software development process. Rigorous tests have shown that even the best performing SAST tools only identify a portion of memory issues in even the simplest software programs and usually generate many false positives. In contrast to SAST, dynamic analysis examines the code while it is executing. DAST requires a running application. This means most issues will not be identified until late in the development cycle, making the identified problem more expensive to fix and regressively test. DAST can only identify issues with code that is on the execution path when the tool is run, so code coverage is also an issue. However, DAST has a much lower percentage of false positives than SAST. Issues such as a memory leak can be identified by DAST, but the underlying cause of the memory issue may be very difficult to identify in the software. Neither SAST nor DAST can make non-memory safe code totally memory safe. Since all tools have their strengths and weaknesses, it's recommended that multiple SAST and DAST tools be run to increase the chances that memory or other issues are identified. Working through the issues identified by the tools can take considerable work, but will result in more robust and secure code. Vulnerability correlation tools can intake the results from multiple tools and integrate them into a single report to simplify and help prioritize analysis. Couple last points. Auto exploitation features. The compilation and execution environment can be used to make it more difficult for cyber actors to exploit memory management issues. Most of these added features focus on limiting where code can be executed in memory and making memory layout unpredictable, which, of course, we've talked about extensively before. They said, as a result, this reduces a malicious actor's opportunities to use the exploitation tradecraft of executing data as code and overriding a return address to direct program flow to a nefarious location. Leveraging options such as Control Flow Guard, CFG, will place restrictions on where code can be executed. Similarly, Address Space Layout Randomization, ASLR, or Data Execution Prevention, DEP, add unpredictability to where items are located in memory and prevent data from being executed as code. Bypassing ASLR and DEP is not insurmountable to a malicious actor, but it makes developing an exploit much more difficult and lowers the odds of an exploit succeeding. Anti-exploitation features can help mitigate vulnerabilities in both memory-safe and non-memory-safe languages. So they conclude, memory issues in software comprise a large portion of the exploitable vulnerabilities in existence. NSA advises organizations to consider making a strategic shift from programming languages that provide little or no inherent memory protection, such as C and C++, to a memory-safe language when possible. Once again, some examples of memory-safe languages include C#, Go, Java, Ruby, Rust, and Swift. Memory-safe languages provide differing degrees of memory usage protections, so available code hardening defenses such as compiler options, tool analysis, and operating system configurations should be used for their protections as well. By using memory-safe languages and available code hardening defenses, many memory vulnerabilities can be prevented, mitigated, or made very difficult for cyber actors to exploit. So, okay, I wanted everyone to hear and to consider that. And for those of our listeners who may be in positions where a choice of implementation language can be made for applications where the program's security and integrity would be important, you know, consider perhaps breaking with a status quo that's been established and choose to bite the bullet and make a switch to a more secure programming language and environment. You know, take the relatively new Rust language, for example. Since its first release in January of 2014, Rust has been adopted by companies including Amazon, Discord, Dropbox, Facebook, Mozilla, Google, and Microsoft. You know, and it's a systems implementation language. It does not slow things down. Should changing to a memory-safe language not be feasible for whatever reason, at least consider looking into the idea of using those static and dynamic analysis tools against your existing code base. You know, you don't have to treat what they say as gospel, but check out everything that they flag to make sure that it's not a problem. You may find that a chunk of those things are problems and be glad that you just ran this thing over your code to see what it thinks. You know, all of that should really pay off.
Are all garbage collected languages memory safe? In theory, they would trigger an error at runtime if you had addressed memory that didn't exist, right? It'd crash.
Yeah, I think so. Unless you used a pointer that was still available to you that no longer pointed to anything.
The compiler should catch that.
And we often see those use after free problems.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, Rust actually doesn't do garbage collection. It does something a little more complex, but Rust is very cool.
not a great language if you don't want to spend a lot of time learning it. But
yeah, I think Rust uses usage counting.
Exactly.
As I recall.
Yeah, reference to reference. And, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Count by reference. Sort of. It's kind of. It's really clever. It's unique. I think.
And we do hear that Rust has a steep learning curve.
Oh, it does. But, I tried. It's if you use Java, it should be pretty straightforward. If you're already using one of those languages that has a lot of, you know, declarative stuff, it should feel fairly comfortable to you. It's not as bad
again,
as some.
You know, C is showing its age.
Yeah.
C++ is a mixed blessing. Even its developer agrees that it sort of didn't work out the
if
way
if your language has malloc or calloc, that's pretty good sign you should not be using it, right?
Yeah.
That's for sure. Very good. I think this is great. So did you write this? Is almost like a column. Did you write this like a column? Like you should submit this to somebody.
Well, the NSA submitted it to the world.
Oh, it's the NSA. Oh, that explains it. Yeah.
Yes.
Because that's what it feels like. It feels like a column.
Yep.
Okay, yes.
Yep.
I missed that. I missed that one.
Yep. I just wanted to share it because I thought
we made a
bunch of really good points.
Yeah. People forget the NSA has a couple of missions, one of which is to secure us at home through proper practices, whether it's hardening our machines or writing safe code. So that's a big part of the job, as well as, you know, spying on people and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. All that.
Sometimes those are incompatible, right? You know, if you want to spy on them, you don't want to use them to use anything secure. That's wrong. Steve, great stuff as always. Steve Gibson is at grc.com. That's his website. Now, there's a lot there. So let me point you to a couple of things. I mean, it's just fun to browse around. But of course, that's where you'll find SpinRite, which is Steve's bread and butter, the world's best mass storage maintenance and recovery utility. Currently 6.0, soon to be 6.1. He's very close now. You'll get a free upgrade if you buy now.
Yep.
Get nervous?
Like, yeah, I'm getting nervous.
Do you have a button that you push that's like release the Kraken?
Well, there's just like so many little details,
I know.
It's like, but exciting. So I'm excited.
And see, Steve, this is good, and you should understand this. Steve isn't one of those people who releases it, sees what the bugs are, and then fixes them. Steve wants to release a perfect piece of software from version 1.0. So that would make me nervous too.
In 2004, SpinRite 6 was released, and there are no known bugs.
Haven't patched it since. That's kind of amazing, really amazing. So that's one thing. SpinRite, probably grc.com/SpinRite. It'd probably take you there. You also should take a look at the podcast because he has two copies of the podcast that we don't have on our Twitch site. One is the 16 kilobit audio. It's a little scratchy. But if you have limited bandwidth, it's the smallest version. Actually, it's the second smallest version because the smallest version, I'm sure, is text only. That's the transcriptions Lane Ferris does, which are great. You might want them separately. You might want them together with the audio so you can read along as you listen. And it's certainly a utility you can use to search for part of any of the shows, any of the 897 shows, and find those comments right in the show. So it's really, really a great thing. He also has 64 kilobit audio, the full quality audio. We have that and video at our website, twit.tv/SN. You can also find Security Now on YouTube. There's a YouTube channel, probably. I'm not sure, but I think it's youtube.com/Security Now. If you go to youtube.com/twit, you'll find, besides all the twit bits and the shorts and stuff, you'll find a list of all the shows, and you can subscribe from there as well. Of course, the easiest thing to do probably for most people is to find a podcast player you like and subscribe to Security Now in that. That way you'll get it automatically as soon as it's available. It downloads automatically. You can listen whenever you want. If you want to watch us do it live, get the very first pressing, the EVU Security Now. You can I never really thought of it that way, but I guess so. You can go watch us live at live.twit.tv. Every Tuesday, right after Mac Break Weekly, that time will vary somewhere around 1:30 or 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC, live.twit.tv. We invite you to join Club Twit if you are not already a member, because that'll give you ad-free versions of this show and all the shows we do. Just $7 a month, you also get access to the Discord, the Twit Plus feed, a bunch of shows we don't put out in public, like Hands on Windows, Hands on Mac, the Untitled Linux Show, the Giz Fizz, and Stacey's Book Club and more to come all the time. That Discord is so much fun as well. And by joining Club Twit for $7 a month, you also support our forums at twit.community. Those are open to all, not just club members, but that's the only way we have of monetizing them. Same thing with our Mastodon instance, which has grown, let me just see, the last time I checked, it has grown 15,000%. I don't even know what 15,000% means. That's like a weird number.
150 times.
150 yeah. times. No, I'm sorry. 22,791%. So we have 2,518 new users. We're up over 3,000 active users now. A lot of people turning to Mastodon to retreat from Twitter, or at least to prepare a hidey hole should Twitter go crazy. My suggestion, if you want to get on Mastodon, is find a server that suits you. But if you're a Twit fan, twit.social is a bunch of Twit fans. You have to be a Twit fan to join it. It's invitation only. Just go there and ask for an invitation. And I'm adding about 100 new people every single day, 100 to 200 new people every single day. It's pretty wild, but it's fun. And we thank our Club Twit members because they're the ones who are paying for this sucker. it's getting a little expensive, actually. It was 15 euros a month until about 2 weeks ago. Then Elon takes over Twitter, and now I'm paying 350 bucks a month. It went up a little. That's a few thousand percent. All right, Steve, have a wonderful week. I know we'll be watching the TV in a couple of hours
to find out what's happening.
Yeah. And I will see you back here next week on Security Now.
Righto. Bye.
The world is changing rapidly. So rapidly, in fact, that it's hard to keep up. That's why Micah Sargent and I, Jason Howell, talk with the people making and breaking the tech news on Tech News Weekly every Thursday. They know these stories better than anyone. So why not get them to talk about it in their own words? Subscribe to Tech News Weekly and you won't miss a beat every Thursday at twit.tv. Security.